Mr. Snake was my father.
There's your intro.
There it is. We found it.
Please. My father was Mr. Snake.
Is he? I don't know a lot of trivia about Escape from New York, which is what we're covering today. I don't know a lot about it. What came first, the name Snake or the Snake tattoo?
Oh, man, I don't know. I'm going to pull up IMDb trivia right now while we talk just to see if anything interesting comes up. Because I didn't check either. It's funny. I just love this movie, and I've never really looked into, like, how it was made. Which, it's like, I know it uses a lot of dope-ass miniatures and shit, so I'm pretty sure I would love how it was made. I don't know why I've ever, I've never really dug into it.
Yeah, there's...
All right. Go ahead.
There's a moment where, like... Snake's flying into New York, and like that 3D frame wiring computer screen readout is on the displays, and I'm just like, I think I could watch this for 2 hours like, with this exact music happening. God, that was so cool.
Oh, there is some dope trivia that will work into the episode.
Now, Denny, I will. I guess I got to intro the podcast. I got to tell people who we
Please.
Are, what we're doing, and
yeah.
the status of things. This is part 8, folks, of the Movies for Win Royal Rumble. The director Royal Rumble, folks, it's here. We, not too much of a surprise entrant, but someone we should have thought of sooner.
Mm-hmm.
Mr.
Mm-hmm.
John Carpenter has entered the ring, along with Quentin Tarantino and... Of course, the director we covered last week, who I'm not stalling for time to get, it's the Coen brothers. They're also in there. They're operating as a tag team, though. The two-headed mm-hmm. wrestler, if I may.
Sure.
So yeah, 3 entrants into the ring, and Mr. Carpenter has brought with him Escape from New York. That's what we're going to be talking about today. We're going to have a great time with it.
We are indeed, Greg. We are indeed. I think, like, it's interesting how the Rumble has shaken out because... we had a lot of prestige in the first half, we kind of ditched it a couple weeks ago, and now we have a whole lot of fun. We have Inglourious Basterds, we have The Big Lebowski, we have Escape from New York, and not to be the Sam Elliott of the situation, but I happen to know there's a little more fun on the way next week. So I think I think we're going to have a really good finale to what has been a very interesting venture for us. I've enjoyed it.
Yeah, and I think I would call Lebowski and Inglourious Basterds prestige fun.
Yeah, no, I would agree. They're both movies I gave a 52, like a perfect score. But when you look at, like, The Big Lebowski versus Seven Samurai, and you hear me say I gave both of those movies a 50, a lot of people are going to say, what? You know what I'm saying?
Just in general. Just a question. Mm-hmm. No, I think that's more than valid. Hell yeah. Well, I don't know your score for Escape from New York.
Shit, so. I don't either. I should look it up. I didn't even bother rescoring it. I love this flick.
Yeah, peek behind the curtain. Denny answered the call here, and I realized I didn't have 2 gimmicks typed out. I was fully unprepared for this one. Much like this movie, I'm just riding on vibes and having mm-hmm. here for a good time and riding on vibes. And this is the movie for it. So
yes.
Before we talk about John Carpenter and his super awesome action thriller,
action sci-fi. I guess action it's not really sci-fi. A sci-fi. No, it's not. It has a sci-fi feel to it. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'd classify it as Escape from New York. You know, like that's mm-hmm. that's what kind of movie it is. It's a John Carpenter movie. He doesn't really have a definitive style. He does something creative every fucking time. And this is one of the greatest examples of that.
Hell yeah. Before we get into it, of course, like I was saying, we first got to talk about some of the things we watched since last we spoke about Big Lebowski. What else have you been watching lately, Denny?
I got a few fun things. So as Instagram followers of @moviesforwin will know, I've recently gotten a really, really cool swivel RCA color track TV set. It's a CRT TV from like 1986. I got a really nice VCR DVD player, and I got an okay Super Nintendo that I need to see if it has problems with some game graphics or if the TV is so old it can't load the like more 3D elements of some of the later Super Nintendo games. All that goes to say, I have been watching some fucking tapes, Greg. Right now, the functioning VCR is in here in my office where we're recording, and sometimes I come in here and pop in a VHS, but I really have to like isolate myself from Vanessa and all of our animals to do that, which is not something I enjoy. So now there's a VCR in a functional space, especially one that the cats love. And so I've just been going through shit I've had sitting on shelves that I haven't really checked out yet. I mean, the first one I've seen before, but I hadn't watched my tape of it. Are you familiar with the Olivia Newton-John Gene Kelly classic Xanadu?
You texted me about this, and I'm only familiar with it because I play a daily like movie trivia game called Framed, and you get like 6 chances to guess what the movie of the day is, and each time you get it wrong, it gives you a little bit more obvious of a clue. And they have different kind of games like guess the poster, you know, guess whatever. And Xanadu has shown up on there like two or three different games that they have, and it's just, it looks bizarre. It looks insane. It looks like the movie you should be watching on the TV that you just got.
That's why it was my first tape I popped in. So a little background on Xanadu. Xanadu is the reason the Razzies were created. It is such a bad movie that someone was like, I must create a platform from which to shit upon this film. That's why the Razzies are still a thing. I found out about it mostly because my favorite alcoholic narcissist, Dan Harmon, used to outro his podcast to this song, much like to the main song from Xanadu, just like our What's My Cage Again outro. Man, this is a crazy, psychedelic, roller skating movie. It's from a time when Olivia Newton-John was like a very popular actor and pop star. And it has Gene Kelly. Gene Kelly is a correct one, right? I always mix up the old school Hollywood dudes. Singing in the Rain. Yeah, no, Gene Kelly is a fucking one of the most acclaimed song and dance men in the history of like American cinema. He's the lead of Singing in the Rain. And Xanadu is his last on-screen performance. And he is a big part of the movie, and he even has he even has like a couple of really good numbers. And like the songs in Xanadu are really fun, but it's crazy to see. It's kind of like when we were seeing Christopher Lee in Howling 2, Sturbo Werewolf Bitch, where you just have this like amazing actor, legendary actor, in this mess of a film. And then for some reason, in what is like an all-time B movie, you see one of the Hollywood greats of all time approaching it like an absolute professional. It's just like so weird to see Gene Kelly take this so seriously. It is a really fun movie, and let me tell you guys, it is the type of bad that people spent a lot of money on, which makes it very fun to watch. There are some there's some real razzle dazzle to Xanadu. We should really be covering it one day. I listen to the song Xanadu on like a regular basis. It's like so fucking cool.
Some razzy dazzy.
Dude, like you wouldn't believe. Think like Footlight Parade, you know, like all those like old school, like we don't know how to make a movie, so we're gonna put a musical at Christmas time and call it White Christmas type of shit. It's like if you're watching one of those big chorus line, like massive cast, costumes, choreography, giant sets, like it's all crazy, and it's all for like the dumbest shit you've ever seen in your life. Which is like, it's just, So that people worked so fucking hard, like talented people worked unbelievably hard on this catastrophe. And it's a joyful catastrophe. Let me tell you, you're not sitting there looking down your nose at it. You're just like, God, I love this psychedelic scene where they go to meet Zeus and ask if he can open a roller skate club.
Sold, baby.
Another tape I've had sitting around for a while is Nightmare on Elm Street 5, Dream Child. I've seen this movie, of course. I've seen all the nightmares. Honestly, I think this is my second watch of the movie because I don't really get into the Nightmare franchise as much as I do Friday. This is a good one, though. If you've seen one Nightmare, you've seen them all, but this one has some really good kills, some really memorable ones, and that's not always the case. Greg, I got duped. So, uh-oh. I have had this amazingly cool cover art VHS called Club Extinction, where the
cool title,
isn't it? The front is this like cool sci-fi. It kind of reminds me of like Fantastic Planet art. On the back, you see this shot of like a woman in like a cool punk club. It kind of reminds me of the clubs they were at in Terminator 1, if you know what I'm talking about, like with the cages and the dark lights and the goth spikes. The movie was absolutely nothing like that. It was a little bit interesting, but it's just like it's like a 60s. You know, like kind of, it's not a spy thriller, but when I say 60s spy thriller, you know what I mean? It's about this, like, you know what? I'm not really going to get super into it. It's 2 hours long. It's okay. I could have lived without it. I like
the
cover.
Sorry, you got tricked.
Thanks. I liked the box art better. You know, I was really looking forward to that. I still have the box art on display because it's really cool. I watched Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Because I needed a little more Coen, Greg. I needed a little more Coen after what
and
we did last week.
That's a good amount. That's a good movie.
Yeah, dude. It's pretty fantastic. I think this is the one that probably reached the most non-film fans, I would say. Like, people who don't really like movies but are of, like, a certain age, like Gen X or Millennial, they love Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? And they don't even really know who the... They don't know who the Coen brothers are. You know what I'm saying? They just think it's a great movie.
Yeah. I think I might have mentioned it last episode. I think that might have been my exposure to them. I might have mentioned that in the past or something.
Sure.
I don't know. But
I know it was my first one. Definitely my first Coen brothers movie because I saw it in like middle school, you know?
Yeah, it came out when we were like 10 or 11 or something. It was like just the
early odds. Yeah.
Yeah, it was like just the right kind of story, like just the right kind of a time for like us to really be into it. And of course, like you said, my parents super into it.
Well, now that I'm thinking about it too, based on the Odyssey, it actually has a very different story structure than most Coen brothers movies, and it's actually like a lot more linear. We follow, you know, like one group of characters. We don't really get a ton of access to things they don't know about. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And it also ends, you know, like it wraps up like a typical narrative. And now that I think of it, I can't really think of another Coen brothers movie that does. You know, so I'll bet it's just like much more. It's like all of the greatness of the Coen brothers and what they do, but without some of the inaccessibility that comes with being a casual moviegoer and not really wanting to give a shit about, like, Bottle Rocket. Oh, wait, no, Bottle Rocket's Wes Anderson. Jesus Christ. What's the first Coen Brothers movie? Barton Fink.
Miller's Crossing.
You know what I mean, though.
Blood Simple. There we go.
There's a lot of people who would watch Barton first. Fink and say, what the fuck was that? You know, like, they'd be like, give me fucking Terminator 2 or whatever. All that goes to say, sorry, I'm listening to the Escape from New York soundtrack to get the vibe, and it just switched to like the stage show they do. about it. And I was like, sorry, I've got to change this track. It is breaking my fucking focus. Anyway, I figure we'll probably cover this one day. So I didn't want to get like too in depth into it. Cause it's a pretty heavy hitter Coen brothers movie.
Yeah, for sure.
I watch Beetlejuice so often that I normally don't even mention it when I watch it. But this one was special because I watched it on Michael Keaton's birthday. I just felt like I needed to do a little something for the guy. And It was also special because I watched my Japanese Beetlejuice VHS on the new TV. So it was also a very immersive Beetlejuice experience.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So cool.
Japanese subtitles on your Beetlejuice and Japanese commercials before it starts. It was really fucking sick.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Following... Konichi, what a time.
Don't say it three times. Okay. I watched another fun little movie called Ghost Chase. It okay. actually ended up being like more charming than I thought. It's absolutely a failing grade, but it's about these like filmmaker dudes who really like love practical effects and cool shit like that, but they're also fucking assholes to women. So it's hard to like them too much. But there's like this old photo of their grandpa. And this, like, spooky-looking, like, little short guy with really big eyes and a really round head. And so they make a puppet out of that. And then the ghost from the photo inhabits the puppet. This is like, the first act. Keep up with me here. they go on adventures, and it's really fun. And it's also, like, a very stupid movie that is, like, not to be taken seriously. But in that regard... I actually had a very good time watching it. Ghost Chase is a fun little hidden gem underneath the piles of VHSs that I have sitting around at my house. Mm-hmm. And then one that I went to see not on a VCR but on a dazzling movie screen at Alamo Drafthouse. I saw Freaky Friday, starring Lindsay Lohan and Jamie Lee Curtis, even more than last time. Man, I'm going to be honest with you. This is not a Happy Gilmore 2 situation. Vanessa okay. and I went together, and we both found it very charming. And there's actually some, like, legitimately funny lines in the movie. Like, it got actual laughs out of me. They do some, like, random stuff that shows, like, a little directorial personality, which I wasn't expecting. Mm-hmm. It is shot so much better than the first Freaky Friday. Much mm-hmm. more visually going on here. It is basically the same thing as last time, but double, which is, I mean, I don't know. It has been like 20 years, you know, like I don't mind it as much, but right. it's definitely like, I don't want to give it more credit than it deserves. 'Cause it's like a cash grab reboot, you know, but I don't watch most of those because they upset me. This didn't upset me. I think it would have been a stronger film if they kept a few brands out of it. Like, there's a scene where they're, like, really at Starbucks and another scene where they're, like, really at Walgreens. Like, you know, you are constantly reminded that it's a Walgreens. You see a lot of logos. And so, like, those parts felt like they don't belong in a movie to me. You know, like that felt like celebrities doing a TV spot, you know, but I will say I am a lifelong devotee to Lindsay Lohan. When I was very young, basically from when I was in third grade to ninth grade, I had a torrid, one-sided emotional love affair with Lindsay Lohan. It was mutual when we ended it. We both agreed that Herbie Fully Loaded wasn't for us and we just went our separate ways. But man... I'm really happy to see her getting work. I'm really happy to see her in the spotlight. I think most of the It girls of the 2000s have had really bad hands dealt to them and have had really unfair lives. And I fucking love Lindsay Lohan. She was great in the movie. It was good to see her back. Even better, guys, in Freakier Friday, no one is having more fun than Jamie Lee Curtis. She is like energetic. She is not there for the check. This is some love of the game shit from Jamie Lee Curtis. Like, she's putting on prosthetics. She's going into hair and makeup. Like, dude, like she's in it. Like, she is here to do the fucking movie. And I love seeing her at the end of her career have so much fun, because she didn't really do a lot of comedy earlier in her career, you know, like
no.
She was first like absolute boss bitch because that's who she is, and then they had this weird thing in the 90s where they wanted to like cast her as a trad wife and shit, you know, like they wanted to like put her in an office building or that, and honestly that's kind of what the first Freaky Friday is, to be honest with you. I mean, is an example of that Jamie Lee Curtis 90s 2000s weird relationship they had with this performer. I just love what's up.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I I gotta tell you, I think the reason that she was so energetic and full of life and youthful in that movie, I think it's because she got body swapped with Lindsay Lohan.
I don't
think you were paying attention to the plot.
Oh my god!
Well,
if you were paying attention to the plot, you would know that she got body swapped with her potential stepdaughter. So Lindsay Lohan switches place with her daughter. Jamie Lee Curtis switches place with the daughter of the person Lindsay Lohan is about to marry. And so
I've seen the movie.
I honestly don't really understand how that would work within the logic of the film, but I think they were just going to do it anyway because, well, who gives a shit? One final thing. They definitely did the annoying reboot thing where, I will say, they didn't make every little thing from the first movie mean something. They didn't, like, go back to this one room. They didn't go back to the Chinese restaurant. You know, like, they didn't do that annoying shit. But they did have a lot of people from the first movie showing up. And in fact, I was actually amazed at how many people from the first movie they were able to track down and get back in this movie. And again, I think it would have been... I'll say this. I'm fine with fan service as long as it pops me. Okay? You know? Like, and some of it did pop me. I just don't like it when I don't get excited about it. Again, it would have been a stronger movie if they did less of that. But what I will say... Not to criticize anyone for their looks, but something that has not been allowed in Hollywood is for women to age. And this is a brand new movie with starring, like, at the top of the bill, a woman who I believe, I don't know how old Jamie Lee Curtis is. I'd guess in her 60s. I think Lindsay Lohan is a year older than me, so that makes her in her late 30s. You know, we talked about age differences when Lindsay and I were, you know, when we had our thing. She was hard to get a hold of, but I talked about it a lot. but all that goes to say, it was just really interesting to see that the aging women in this movie looked beautiful, and the aging men looked like fucking dog shit. who's the guy from Burn Notice? He's Jamie Lee Curtis's husband in Freaky Friday, and he's on Burn Notice, and that's all he ever did. NCIS. Not Burn Notice, NCIS, sorry.
You knew what Burn Notice was.
Mark fucking Harmon, okay? Yeah.
Okay.
I know what Burn Notice and NCIS are because I had to watch so many fucking commercials for them because WWE Raw used to be on USA. No, I will never watch them. No, they never looked fucking... interesting to me in the slightest, but I'm very familiar with their existence. But Mark Harmon, and I really don't mean to be harsh on someone's looks. He's in his 70s, we looked up. He was moving around and talking in this movie and looking like someone in their 90s. Like, I, like, legitimately, ooh, like, felt so sorry for him. He could barely speak. He doesn't sound like a TV actor. He sounds like your grandpa, which is not bad. You know, he's allowed to turn into a grandpa, but it's just like, he just looked like he was physically struggling to do the movie. There's even a point where he picks up Jamie Lee Curtis off the ground, and it's just so fucking obvious that it's a body double. Like, they don't let you get anywhere near his face. He's moving so much faster than he moves in the rest of the movie. And so all that goes to say, I thought just, like, the differences in looks were interesting. Chad Michael Murray is, like, obviously a crazy good-looking person, right? But, like, seriously, you see him in the first movie, and you're like, oh, that's just, like, your classic tween crush, hunky boy. You know, like, there's one every generation or so, or a handful every generation. Like, dude, he's in the movie, and he looks like a hot guy, but he's not, like, breathtakingly hot. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's just... shout out to the women for looking fantastic as they age, and also being allowed to look aged in a Hollywood movie. They did look older. It was awesome. They should be allowed to have that. So that's my half episode on Freakier Friday. Sorry about that. I had a lot of thoughts, it turns out. My bad, gang. Greg, what have you been watching?
Well, shoot. I'll get into successful reboots at the end of this. That's a little teaser for the folks. But first, I watched a Greg movie. It's on Hulu. It's called Small Things Like These, and it came out a few months after Oppenheimer. It stars Cillian Murphy, I should say that. came out a few months after Oppenheimer, and it, you know, Oppenheimer was Cillian Murphy's Oscar-winning role, and he was better in this movie. I thought it was good. I liked it a lot. Set in his native Ireland, was really good. But you're not going to believe this, Denny, but the Catholic Church is up to something nefarious.
In Ireland? Of all places, Greg. Of all places.
Oh, man. I couldn't believe it either. But yeah, it was a good movie. Definitely a Greg movie. Check it out if that's your thing. Talking to everybody. But Denny, I think this time. I think you would appreciate it. Maybe not enjoy it. A movie that I do think you would enjoy, Denny. It was a genuine surprise to me that this was good. Disney Pixar's Elio, I think.
Okay, yeah.
It was actually good. Pixar Rock came on. Out with a good movie in the year 2025. That's crazy.
Okay, because I skipped it because I was like, seeing it, I just feel like, you know, for the past decade, Pixar has just been so paint by numbers that I've just been over it.
Yeah, it's the Disneyfication of it, and Pixar kind of used to be their own thing,
right?
And the lines have just gotten blurred, and good stories just stopped getting made there, and it was a real shame because, you know, they started out so hot and then just came crashing down. But Elio was good. It's very charming. I don't think it's like, you know, a return to form by any means for them, but like it's good. I think it was a good time. Definitely not a waste of, you know, less than 2 hours, whatever it was. A movie that I was expecting to be good and was good, not recently, but since eliminated director Akira Kurosawa eliminated from the Royal Rumble, and he's been dead a while.
You've been eliminated from life's Royal Rumble is how I want my death pronounced at the hospital, please.
Yeah, I hate to break the news to anybody out there that Kurosawa has passed on, but I watched his movie Ran, which was one of his color movies, which he doesn't have a lot of. It was a adaptation of King Lear, and I was kind of expecting, like, because we watched Dreams, and that was in color, and that was striking, of course. But I think this time I noticed it more because it's more of a, you know, obviously a traditional story. Mm-hmm. I was expecting him to use color in a way that's, like, just better than his contemporaries at the time. But he used color in a way that's unlike anything I've ever seen. It's really cool. Like, you know, there's a scene with a battle at a castle, and, like, the soil there is like this dark, almost black soil, and then like they're using bright red paint as blood. It's just like super, just high contrast, super interesting color choices. It looks great. It's a cool movie. It's pretty long though. It's like 2 hours 40 minutes or something, so again, won't recommend it to Denny, but it's, man, Kurosawa movies, just, I don't know. The ultimate Greg movies, I guess. It was great. I really liked it. Next, a director that we have covered once in the past, but I'm not going to talk too much about the movie because I kind of want Denny to watch it. This one I will recommend to Denny. Denny, okay. Park Chan-wook directed a movie called The Handmaiden.
Okay.
In 2016. Go in as blind as possible, I would say. Cool.
Now, is this his adaptation of The Handmaid's Tale?
No, it is an adaptation of another book. I can't remember. It's an English book. I can't remember. English as in British. And, you know. I can't remember the name of the book, but it is a book adaptation complete with his own kind of personality and twist to it. Mm. So it's really good. Watch The Handmaiden. It's sick. Well worth your time. I think it's better than Old Boy, personally.
Shit.
Yeah, okay. It's sick. This is like watching a master at work. It's fantastic. A little less good. Very much less good. I watched the Phineas and Ferb movie.
Ooh.
We've been
the new father, ladies and gentlemen.
That's exactly right. So Phineas and Ferb wasn't on my radar again. Didn't have cable as a kid, and I was a little too old for it when the show came out. my wife, that was her more her demographic, and she started just, you know, putting the cartoon on in the background, you know, entertain the kid while we're cooking or whatever, and the show is legitimately good and funny. I really like the show Phineas and Ferb. It's a blast. It's a real treat. So I was like, ah, the movie could capture a lot of that same fun, and it kind of sucked. The movie kind of sucked. To quote Abed Nadir Denny, heavy-handed drama to create the illusion of story. Characters just departing what we know them as to just force conflict, and it kind of sucked. They tried to push a little too hard away from what made the show good, and it just to, you know, create a longer narrative, and it didn't really work. But I did laugh out loud a pretty good amount of time, so not the worst time ever on the old Disney Plus, especially for a 70 or 80 minute movie. Short. And lastly, Denny, I stayed animated, but I did. I was approaching this with cautious optimism. The new season of King of the Hill.
Ooh, yeah, I haven't checked it out. You're an expert. I would love to hear your thoughts.
I really like it. Really do like it. I thought it was very good. We've talked a lot in the show about TV shows or movies, even where if it's a reboot and you get all the same creators, like writers, directors, like actors. If too much time has passed, we've said that, like, it's really hard to get everyone back in the same headspace.
Right.
You know, to, like, kind of create the same, maybe not necessarily the same sort of magic, but even, like, the same kind of tone of what we're trying to get. Like, not the case here. I feel like we only spent a few minutes kind of playing catch-up on, you know, what we've been. Because it's, you know, it's set now. It's set in modern time. Time has gone on. But it was really good. They just started telling their fun little stories again. And it wasn't, you know, it was, I don't know, they hit the tone.
Yeah.
Less time with member berries and more getting on with their cute little stories. They weren't going for low-hanging fruit, like the obvious jokes of Hank being an old conservative in 2025. They could have made it a lot worse. And it was actually really good. It was funny.
That's awesome.
A real treat.
Let me ask this.
Mm-hmm.
I think I've only seen through season 4 or 5 of the original show. Do I need to finish that out before I jump into the new season?
I don't think you need to finish it out, because there's some characters that don't even... More stuff happens to characters that aren't in the new season, if that makes sense. I think you should watch the first, like... I would give it, like, 2 or 3 more seasons? I can't remember...
I honestly don't know why I'm even acting like there's any other option for me than watching the whole thing.
Oh, right.
I don't know why I'm pretending I'm capable of this. I'm going to watch it all. I'll get around to it. Great. Okay. Your recommendation makes me want to do that sooner, I guess, is what I would say.
It's easy to get back into. Don't worry.
It was a pandemic show for me.
Oh, gotcha. Understood. It was a at-home-with-a-kiddo show for me.
Well, like... No joke, I never really watched it because I grew up in McKinney, which is not very far from the places King of the Hill is based on. And so when I was a kid, I didn't understand that it was a comedy. I was literally just like, who would watch a cartoon about my parents and their friends? You know, like, I was just like, dude, this is just how normal people act. And then as an adult, with a little more perspective on the strange part of the world I grew up in, I'm like, oh, okay, this is funny.
Yeah, same exact story for me. It didn't click, especially at first, because it came out like 99, something like that.
Yeah, maybe sounds 90, right. 97, maybe earlier. Something.
Yeah, I think it was like 96 or 97. It's just, even in, we, you know, grew up a little bit, and we're deeper into the seasons. Like, as it was going, we grew up in Texas, and these are just my parents and my friend's parents. Like, this isn't really... What are the jokes? And then I grew up and I got the jokes. So,
yep.
Yeah.
I met some people other than my parents and their friends, and you wouldn't believe how it changed me.
Mm-hmm. Something called shocking. Well, Denny, speaking of things that are, well, I guess not easy to get into, like a prison island called New York City, are we ready to glide into John Carpenter's Escape from New York from 1981 that you can watch now on Amazon Prime, folks.
Greg, I wouldn't escape from this podcast if I could, but I would keep the audio file on cassette tape and, you know, make sure it's not used to end any wars.
As long as the B-side has some sweet jams to play in the cab. All right, Escape from New York. I'll summarize the plot for us really quickly, because the title of the movie summarizes the plot, so folks. This is... You get what you fucking expect. This is telling you what you're going to get, and you're going to have a great time with it. Oh my god, and it just delivers. Hits all the marks. Escape from New York stars Kurt Russell. He plays a man with an eye patch named Snake Plissken, and the president of the United States. His plane has gone down in New York City. It's 1997. New York, the island of Manhattan, is now a prison island. And his plane has been hijacked and crashed, but he's got an escape pod. The president is somewhere in New York, and it is up to Snake Plissken, who has just been given a life sentence, to go in, infiltrate the island, return the president, or he dies in 24 hours. It's all very important. And that's it. That's all you need. New York at night with Kurt Russell running around.
Yeah, dude.
Yeah, it's fucking sick.
It's just... My first note before we do relationships, because it's just so quick, is the first thing I wrote down was, this is the coolest fucking idea for a movie. Like, what you just described is, like, the coolest fucking, like, type of shit you'd pitch with your friends in high school idea for a movie I've ever heard of in my fucking life, and I'm so glad it got made.
And it's, like, the kind of idea that would, you know, get kicked around specifically in the 80s.
Because there was, like, the crime fear. Like, this is a movie for people who thought, like, crime was going to crumble New York City by 1997. You know? Like, that's what people's perceptions were.
And instead, we got something a little bit more believable. More on that here in a second. our Critiker Review of the Week this week. I'll get that out of the way. I found it right before we hit record here. Critical Review of the Week, this user gave it an 89 out of 100 and said, fun fact, Kurt Russell would later reuse the Snake Plissken eye patch for his role as Captain Ron after refusing to wear it just 5 years earlier for his first rapey pirate movie, Overboard.
I didn't know he was, I didn't know, I don't know what Captain Ron is.
I don't know what Captain Ron is from, but... No, it's a movie called Captain Ron. Seems like it's... Oh, he's got an eye patch in it. Yeah. Turns out he was in a lot of rapey pirate movies. Who knew?
90s They're all a little rapey.
Hmm?
All pirate movies are a little rapey.
You know, it goes even to the plundering.
Disney ones.
Except for Muppet Treasure Island, of course.
Very unrapey. Classic unrapey pirate movie, Muppet Treasure Island. Yeah. Fortunately, no sexual content in that movie, which doesn't explain where my puppet fetish comes from, so I'll have to look somewhere else.
I was going to say, fortunately.
I watched this video called Fuck It Christmas Carol when I was a kid by mistake.
Uh-oh. Before this gets out of hand and becomes a Christmas episode, Denny, what is your relationship with Escape from New York?
Man, I talk about my old movie list that Vanessa and I used to do, and they eventually just became like a fun thing to like find obscure things we hadn't watched or to like highlight a director or something. But the first year that we did it was like actually significant to me because for a lot of reasons I missed out on a lot of culture in my life. The first list I made was just me in 2017 being like, I'm the biggest movie nerd I know, and there's like so much just like classic titles I haven't seen. The first year had a lot of fun 80s action movies on it, and Escape from New York was one of them. This was just one of those movies where I like had to make it a priority to see, and it's actually a lot more substantial than the title suggests, because I was pairing it with things like Schwarzenegger's The Running Man, you know, like that's the kind of stuff I was looking for, and those are great movies too, but this one has this one has a really cool political worldview expressed in it, and I really, really like it for that. And I've watched it a handful of times since then. It's something I'm always very agreeable to put on. This time was my favorite watch. I think I was just paying more attention because I knew I'd be reviewing it, and I just picked on a lot more subtlety. You know, felt like I understood the characters and the plot just a little bit better because I was paying a little more attention. So, yeah, my relationship with it is I love it, and I've never had a bad experience with it. What about you, Greg?
Well, similar to your movie list, I would say made this podcast because I'm the biggest movie nerd I know, and I need to watch these classic movies and talk about them. So that's what we're here for. I have never seen Escape from New York until last night.
Man, this was your first watch.
My first watch, which is weird because a couple years ago I did watch Escape from L.A. So, watch that one first for some reason.
And how did that? I saw that one for the first time last spring or last fall, about a year ago.
Yeah, I like this one significantly better. What say you?
Yeah. I think they're both fun, but this one is way better. Yeah, the other one is kind of just more of like a '90s action movie. This one feels like something really special. I also do want to print a retraction to what I just said. I compared this movie to The Running Man, saying The Running Man doesn't have a political subtext. It actually has a political subtext, much like this movie. This was a poor choice of comparisons, but you know what I mean. I'm talking shit like Commando, you know, like shit like Time Cop. This has a lot more substance to it, and so does The Running Man, and that's why people should watch it.
Maybe I will. I actually haven't seen The Running Man either.
It's dope. There's a reboot. A remake coming out this year, I think, that also looks surprisingly decent to me. It's done very differently.
Okay. I think I've heard about the remake coming out, so I should check out the first one first. Well, yeah, let's get into the movie a little bit about John Carpenter and that kind of thing. We've covered The Thing and we've covered Halloween. Mm-hmm. So we've got the heavy hitters out of the way. We kind of landed on Escape from New York purely, like, I don't know if I want to say out of necessity, but it was really like, what else is, like, what are the other heavy hitters? I gave Denny the choice between this movie and They Live, and we just kind of went with this one.
I forgot about that.
Yeah, it's like...
I also threw out In the Mouth of Madness, I'd like to add. That's another fucking awesome Carpenter flick we haven't done.
Ooh. Man. One of the better titles, for sure. So, tell me a little bit about your love for John Carpenter movies, what you consider to be more the heavy hitters. You're definitely more clued in with his movies, his filmography. Why does he deserve to be in the same kind of Royal Rumble conversation with the Coen brothers, with Tarantino, with Scorsese, everyone we've covered so far? What made this guy really stand out for you as someone that needed to throw their hat and body in the ring?
So I think about a year ago, I was trying to take an inventory of which Carpenter movies I'd seen and which ones I still needed to watch. And as I was doing it, I think I just kind of realized that I think he's my favorite director. I'm pretty sure he is. I think I've liked the most of his films out of all the cool directors I've seen. And I also think that, like, it's probably Carpenter and Cronenberg that really speak to me with just like the very niche things that they do. For me, it's seriously like my favorite director is either Carpenter or Tarantino, I think. And I think Carpenter is actually a cool person. And as I've stated at length, I think Quentin Tarantino is a creepy little bastard who has self-appointed himself to speak to black people about race. I don't want to hang out with him. Carpenter, dude. Oh my god, I would hang out with Carpenter for 5 hours and not say a word and just be like, tell me everything you know. Just talk to me. I'll write down the good shit. I love John Carpenter, and I'd say a reason that I think he belongs in this is, one, his attitude towards filmmaking in American Hollywood is very badass because he absolutely hates the capitalism element of it. You can definitely see that in Escape from New York's content. One of my favorite things he ever did with that energy is They Live. We didn't cover it, but I'll share like an intention behind it. Is basically The Thing, which is just like, God, what a great movie. All top of the top, tippy top movies of sci-fi and horror. But it was a big financial failure in the theaters, which is hard to imagine because it's so revered now. It's hard to think that like people would like not give a shit about it.
And so like critics really didn't like the thing either.
No, yeah.
Like, it was like widely regarded as just a bad movie.
Right. And so Carpenter, on some level, realizing he'd created a masterpiece, he made They Live, and his comment on it was, because I used to think They Live was like way too on the nose until I read this. He was like, I know my message is not deep, but I just needed to scream fuck capitalism. I'm like, you know what? That's awesome. I'm with you. So I think his approach to movies, first of all, is like a filmmaker who loves creativity and hates how capitalism gets in the way of creativity. Mm-hmm. Also a unique filmmaker who loves to score his movies. You know, like you hear a lot about like, right, directed and edited, but you don't usually hear like directed and scored. That's not a common combination.
No, really not common. I think I mentioned when we talked about Four Rooms, sorry to bring that back up, but Robert Rodriguez is, oh no, it was when we did comic book Sin City. He's a guy that very, very strong in the opinion that a director should also be editing their movies. Mm-hmm. And that makes a lot of sense to me. It's just doing your own score for your movies is, it makes so much sense, but it's just like such another, it's on the same, you know, side of the brain. It's just this new kind of creativity, but like having the skill to really do it, mm-hmm, is just not a combo you really see. Like, good musicians don't make good filmmakers and vice versa. Not saying that's always true, but it's just maybe not explored very much. You know, a good director hires a good musician or composer to create kind of the feel they want for the movie. And I can't remember I can't even remember the quote or who it's from, but someone said that movies are like 70% sound or something like that. I can't remember what it was. Mm-hmm. So it makes a lot of sense, and I wish I would see it more with directors doing music for their own movies. Like, it's as important as editing. It's, you're creating the feel that you're trying to go for. You have a vision and a feeling in your head. Why not put your own music in there? Like, okay, this is how I want it to feel. Mm-hmm. And this movie, I think, I gotta put it above Halloween for like music setting the mood. As much as I love the music in Halloween, I think
not disagreeing, just wow.
I gotta watch Halloween again to confirm it, but like, again, like absolute hating on it zero. It's like edging it out.
No. Yeah, I'm saying those are two heavy hitters, and it speaks to how much you love this score, is what I was trying to say. I wasn't trying to doubt you. I was saying, if you like it more than Halloween, then you really fucking like it, is essentially what I was saying. Yeah.
It's just so varied for a movie that throughout it looks pretty much the same. It's New Year, it's like the street, New York streets at night with a bunch of people running around.
Right.
It kind of not really super varied, and that's not a bad thing. It's just like we're in this kind of pit of tension. It needs to kind of look the same, but like, just all these crazy wild characters coming in and like different factions, like when we're over here, like the music fits every single flowing mood to this wide range and array. It's just, for a movie that looks very, I don't want to say samey, but like looks very consistent, mm-hmm, the variety of feeling is coming from the score, and it's just, it's unlike anything I've heard. I think it's so sick. More on that in Gimmicks, I think.
Yeah. Well, I did want to say a final thing about why I think Carpenter belongs here. Belongs in the dance with a name like Cure. I seriously think, like, it would be fair to have a reaction to say, like, you're putting John Carpenter's movies on the same level as, like, Martin Scorsese and Akira Kurosawa. You know, like, and I would say, yes, and here's why. This is something that we are adamant about on Movies for When, is that just because something is awesome and fun doesn't make it less of a filmmaking achievement than something that is dramatic and serious, right? Like, mm-hmm, we're very adamant about that on Movies for When, and I think
usually that comment is in the context of a comedy,
right?
Achieving a good joke is as, you know, difficult as it should be, as applauded as like achieving a good dramatic moment, basically.
Yeah, dude. And like, I think when you look at Carpenter's filmography, I'm not saying he's the only director with this kind of range, because he's not, but there are very few that have this kind of range. I would say that if you look at his work, its influence, and the differences in every movie, I'll just name a few. Halloween basically kicked off the first, or kicked off the American slasher craze. It's not the first American slasher, but it is the one that finally clicked. You know, it's like when they finally really got it right in a way that lots of people wanted to see. You look at The Fog. It's about ghost pirates. You look at Big Trouble in Little China. It's about whatever that sentence means. I've seen it multiple times. I don't know how to describe it to you. It's beautiful. you look at In the Mouth of Madness, which is a fucking psychological reality bender about a novel. You look at Escape from New York, and it's an action movie with a premise like no other action movie in the history of the world, or after it, really. You look at, shit, what's another one? I'm trying not to say Prince of Darkness because I don't really like it, actually. It's not very good. but you see what I'm saying is that, like, if you start... They Live is a different one. I don't want to spoil what it's about, but it's, like, it's basically a pulp novel. You know, like, it's like a low-budget-looking movie at times. And I love him for that. And I also love him for, like, only wanting to do what he cares about. Like, he did not want to do Halloween 2 until they told him they were going to do it without him. And he basically didn't think the movie needed to be made, so he got, like, really drunk and wrote it because he didn't have any ideas. And that's when he decided not to let them dangle that carrot in front of him, essentially. But even now, if you get him back for anything, he just likes to score shit now. He's not trying to direct anymore. He just does what he loves to do, which is... make synthy John Carpenter scores, and I've never gotten tired of them. And finally, in the horror anthology Body Bags, easily the best part of the movie, which has one good short and two not so good ones, is John Carpenter is the bumper host. He's the crypt keeper, and he's very, very awesome on camera in this role. If anybody wants to check out a little fun John Carpenter, very rare on-screen appearance, very rare acting work, you should really check out Body Bags. It's a pretty dope example. So that's very like cool. A 30-minute... you know, I obviously didn't need to spend as much time on him as Freaky or Friday, but I do feel like I've really been verbose on the subject. Sorry about that, gang.
Oh, man. Hey, no, I could listen to things about John Carpenter all day. Mm-hmm. Freaky or Friday, maybe less so, but it's whatever.
We'll save that for the sickos.
That's right. That's what the timestamp's for. Yeah, I'm just glad we got a director here that we want to see in front of the camera. Sorry, Quentin.
Yeah, actually, great way to differentiate between my two favorite directors. John Carpenter on camera, I'd love to see it more. Quentin Tarantino on camera. Any time Quentin Tarantino has come up on this podcast, we've talked about how he should never act.
We wish we didn't see him as much.
Right.
This movie's a 10 out of 10, except for, yeah. Yeah, I think you said something about budget. I can't remember. Whatever, you were talking about Carpenter and budget. I feel like this guy could make a movie for like $5,000.
Oh, yeah.
Make it fucking work. This is, like, specifically with The Thing, I believe the person that did the special effects for that movie, which is kind of, like, what makes the movie, was, like, a really untested, like, very young special effects artist, or practical effects artist, and just fucking out of this world. And, like, getting the best work out of everybody involved is a sign of a good director, and... you don't always need a lot of money to do that. I feel like every time I read a story about how one of Carpenter's movies is made, it's always like your average Wikipedia page for a John Carpenter movie would be like cast and then several paragraphs about challenges making the movie and then a little bit about the plot.
How much he didn't like what the studio said, how he fought them tooth and nail. Yeah.
everything went wrong, but he still made it fucking happen.
Yeah, dude. Yeah.
He's just the kind of guy that can just get the shit done and still accomplish his vision. And that deserves a lot of respect. And so, yeah, well,
sorry, I talked over you.
I was finishing my sentence, and I was done.
I'm what's called a conversational jumper, not a waiter, and I know it's rude, and I try to work on it, but I usually fail.
I was rambling, looking for the period.
Well, I lost what I was going to say anyways. I got embarrassed about interrupting you.
Challenges, budget.
Oh, so what you were saying is he's the guy who can always get it done. And I would say that in my briefer experiences making short films, something that I have found has been really valuable, like a valuable teaching moment for me, is times when I've had to just work with what I had. There was no way to reshoot it, you know, like it just couldn't be done and it wasn't what I wanted. And sometimes it was bad footage. And sometimes you have to restructure your shit in editing just because something was unusable, you know, like, and I think that, like, if, you know, like, obviously going to film school was not a, you know, it's not the wisest financial investment. But I would say, like, if there's something I seriously felt like I learned as a person that was a lesson from filmmaking is that, like, sometimes you just have to make what you have work. And I think to what you're saying, John Carpenter could find a way with just about anything. And that's something I really respect in a filmmaker in any stage of the process.
Yeah, exactly. It's the term we love here. It's movie magic, and he just got it. He's got a touch. He's got his hands. It's just they're movie magic is just zapping out of his fingers like lightning.
Absolutely.
Where Steven Spielberg will wield movie magic to make some of the most fun and interesting movies you've ever seen. Please hear this as a compliment. Carpenter is one of the few directors that uses their skills with movie magic for evil.
Right. Well, it's like, great. He very much reminds me of, like, Spielberg with smaller budgets. Not to say he doesn't get big budgets. Like, this movie is a big budget movie, but it's not a fucking E.T. budget. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. And instead of telling fun, whimsical stories, we're telling dark, nasty stories with freaks Carpenter on a prison island.
He is not wholesome. I would say that, like, a good percentage of his filmography is just Donald Pleasance waxing poetic about the nature of evil. You know, that's, like, three or four movies worth of John Carpenter.
Oh, man. And, we got a little bit of old Donald Pleasance in this movie, too.
Yeah, dude.
President Donald apparently established a racist police state. That's weird.
Yeah. Well, honestly, I will say, like, true bald, not like balding, true bald, true face shaved, you know, no 5 o'clock shadow on Mr. Pleasance.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't recognize the guy. You know, like, he doesn't look like Dr. Loomis at all in this movie. Like, they completely shake the character. And I honestly think that might have fucked with immersion. And also, like, I love that they made him look different without a fuck ton of, like, makeup or anything. They just tweaked his look a little. And I think it really, it made him feel not like Donald Pleasance in a way that really worked for the movie. Because I like Donald Pleasance. I don't fucking like this character, you know?
Yeah. I kind of, visually, I clocked him right away. And I was like, is that him? And then he talked. I was like, yeah, that's him. Okay. Just imagine him in a car like, there's nothing you could do to kill him. Wait a second, he's behind us.
You see, if it was really him, if it was truly Donald Pleasance, Snake would have found him and he would have just been like, you don't understand. The Duke, he's not human. He's purely corrupted to his core. We mustn't face him. He is not faceable. You know, like, that's the real Donald Pleasance showing up.
He should have swapped places with Harry Dean Stanton in terms of roles.
Sure.
Harry Dean Stanton, who I was also very surprised to see in this movie. That was great. Love our
old
guy.
Old school, dude. Old school. So, I wanted to talk about how what's really cool about this is that it is a very... we don't like to talk about the real world on this show, and it keeps getting harder and harder not to do. We did it a lot with Eddington last week, and I think you can't talk about this movie without talking about some problems that were expressed in 1987 and have not only not been solved, but have intentionally been made worse between then and now. And I think, like, you know, something I've always said about a lot of people in Gen X that can be really frustrating for me at times is that they can tell you what's wrong with capitalism. They can tell you it's fucked up that money funds everything. They can tell you it's fucked up that our government is bought and paid for. They can tell you it sucks that art is being turned into what it is now. They can tell you it sucks that you are allowed three shapes to build buildings with, and they are all rectangle. Different dimensions of rectangle are all you get. And they can tell you all that stuff sucks, but like what I find very frustrating, not speaking for everyone in Gen X, and also not everyone in Gen X thinks this, by the way, but they can tell you all the problems with society, but because of the way they were socialized, it is really hard for them to say, and that means capitalism is bad. Like, it's very hard for them to put it all together and critique our society as a whole, because they've honestly had it very successfully indoctrinated into them that this is the only way things could possibly be. And anything other than this economic system and this government system is like a total failure, and no one's ever made it work, and it all sucks. And it's so bad that when countries try it, we actually have to bring them democracy to help them. it's not to destabilize socialist economies. It has nothing to do with that. All that goes to say, the movie opens with a woman hijacking Air Force One. Which, I don't know if you've seen the movie Air Force One, but that's not something that's perceived as a positive thing by people of this era. Now you might get some like, yeah, Luigi, fuck him up type of chance for this. But like in the 80s and 90s, like hijacking the president's plane and trying to kill him in the name of social change was not something that good guys in movies did. Okay, and we are definitely supposed, like, the movie opens with, like, a female who has hijacked a plane, which is also, like, we don't usually get to see women in these roles in this era. She is just screaming about, like, you're racist, and you're a prison colony, and you're all gonna fucking see, and we deserve to be free. And even when they, like, cut away from her, she's still screaming, racist! Like, she's, like, fading off into the background. I think that that is something that truly makes John Carpenter a punk rock director, is that he was writing movies like this before the public was really ready to hear it.
And this came out 18 years after the JFK assassination.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And I do think that, like, definitely this was recent enough from the Vietnam War that I think there were enough people that were like, America can be pretty fucking questionable at times. But it was, like, really not in vogue to put it in a movie with, like, absolutely no redeemable elements about them to just be like, the American system of government and society is bad. It's just bad. And if you were cool, you wouldn't like it. Be cool like Snake is essentially what the movie is saying. And I just think you got to give him credit because, like, that truly was punk rock in the sense that it wasn't the type of movie the establishment wanted you making, you know? And I just think that that's a real credit to this movie, that like the whole way through, even in the end of the movie, Snake goes to President Pleasance and is like, hey, you know, I saved your life, but a lot of people died in that process. I just want to know how you feel about it. And he's like, oh, you know, that was cool of them. And he's like, cool. All I needed to see.
And he's like, and then he is that it? I got to be on TV in a couple minutes.
Right, right. And Snake's like, cool. Time to not stop a world war, essentially. We don't really get context for this war that's happening, but there's definitely like there's definitely some implication that there's probably nuclear stuff going on. Like, we get a real quick tip of the play MacGuffin. Sorry, the tape MacGuffin. For those, in case we missed it, the president is abandoned in his prison colony of Manhattan with a briefcase taped to his wrist, and in that briefcase there is a really important tape that must be played by a deadline. That's called a MacGuffin and a deadline in screenwriting terms. So the president is one piece of this movie. They really want the president back. But honestly, the president could die. They actually want that tape more than anything. And one of the coolest moments of the movie, Snake does the old switcheroo with one tape that plays like just like classical kind of big band jazzy music, and the other we get a real quick clip of it, and they're talking about like periodic table stuff. And to me, my headcanon is that like that tape was probably maybe it was a message about a nuclear alternative. You know, like maybe mm-hmm. maybe it was a message about something that could de-escalate this global conflict. And Snake realizes that the people who are having the global conflict are rotten to the fucking core when the president just blows that off. And he gives him the jazz tape, and he fucking destroys our MacGuffin to close the movie out. And you want to talk about a character that fucking hates the imperialist industrial complex that is the United mm-hmm. States. And it is our protagonist. And frankly, in a way that for some reason really bothers me with Marty McFly, but doesn't bother me at all with Snake Plissken, he is never really portrayed as a character with flaws. Like, he's pretty much just like a total badass the whole time without really doing anything too questionable. He even has a pretty good moral compass. You know, he doesn't kill people unnecessarily. You know, he's not his crimes are like trying to overthrow the government, essentially. You know, like he's a fucking badass. And he doesn't have much of an arc. Like, I think the biggest arc you see of him is when he gave the president that chance. He was like, here's one moment that I'm going to look right at, like, the leader of this nation and ask if he feels empathy for people, is essentially what his question was. Mm-hmm. And that was, like, the one moment in the movie where I thought Snake might be open to change. And then he gets his worldview completely reinforced, and he goes on being himself, other than he doesn't let the government call him by his badass name Snake anymore. But what say you? Character without an arc, Snake Plissken. Agree, disagree, thoughts?
I tend to agree. And I will say, he then ends the movie by walking to Los Angeles, and it takes him about 12 years.
Imagine walking all the way to Los Angeles just to find out that in the last 2 years they built another prison colony.
Gotta do this shit again. Oh, brother. Yeah, I think this is more of a... I would agree with you that it is a protagonist without an arc, but I think that's because this is way more limited of a story in terms of scope. Because mm-hmm. the story is 24 hours long. Like, we're introduce this to this character at like minute one of like a 24-hour countdown, right, basically, right. And
show like that.
We don't really get a lot of clues as to who the character is coming into this. They talk a lot about, like, you know, like, oh, we did remember just like this thing in Liberia. We get some accolades of like past jobs that he's done or assignments and that kind of thing. And then it was kind of a surprise to me that when Snake gets onto the island that he is kind of a celebrity of sorts, mm-hmm. and then everyone thought he was right. dead. But like,
right. The lore, right?
Why do you guys know who this is at all? That's very strange. It was very interesting. So
they recognized his face. It's not like they just heard of Snake Plissken. Like, they know what he looks like, you know?
Yeah, the cab driver recognized him from like the side.
Yeah.
And went to go say something. So, I think you're right. I think it is a character without an arc, but I don't think this is a story that necessitates a character, the protagonist, to have an arc.
Right.
We literally just dropped into the plot and told to escape from New York. I feel like we do, like you said, the most character kind of work that we do get is at the end where he's, you know, kind of gut-checking the president to see if he's mm-hmm. capable of empathy and, you know, gets his answer. So... No, I don't think... I mean, yes, I would agree with you, but I don't think it was... And I'm not saying you're saying this. I don't think it's a detriment to the story whatsoever.
No, I think it's an interesting part of the story, is more what yeah. I would say. I think it's interesting, and I think I like it a lot better with Snake than Marty McFly, because Snake's arc isn't so masturbatory, you know? But, like...
Mm-hmm.
So, like, if you've... Forgive my redundancy if you've heard me discuss this concept on the podcast before, because I'm sure I've done it five or more times. Greg will have a timestamp for when I'm done reiterating myself.
No, that's too much work.
But, so, like, if you're going to have a protagonist without an arc, then instead of the lie that the protagonist believes, you must address the lie that the rest of the world believes. And in this case, the lie that the rest of the world believes is that the United States president is somehow important. You know, like, that's something the Duke believes. That's something that, I don't even know what we call the guy who forced him to go on the mission.
Hawk?
Hauk. Yeah, something weird like that. Yeah. He believes the president is really important. Snake has never given a fucking shit about any of this and had to be, like, literally forced at the threat of his life to do this mission. He's literally in a situation that says do this or die, which for many of us reminds us of going to work right now in this society. All that goes to say, I think it's a really badass thing for this movie. I think it really works for this movie. And it also totally works for Back to the Future, just in a very different way. And Back to the Future, I seriously like almost every character except Marty. Like, I just don't like the character Marty McFly. I love the performer. Mm-hmm. I love the performer and I love the performance. But, like, Marty is just a fucking dipshit. Like, he somehow has trouble grasping that he's the only one time traveling and no one else is affected by that change. Just like, what a fucking... And he never overcomes his ability to not become triggered into rage when called a chicken. All that goes to say, that's my rant about... What were we talking about? What movie is this?
Enough about our first episode. Yeah. We're let's get back into New York.
For those who want more of those thoughts, great place to start the anthology, episode one.
Yeah, that's right. I did want to address something that you mentioned. I'm scolding you. You talked about how strange it was that this kind of story got made. It's very punk rock. Like, it's insane that he would even write something like this. I feel like a studio executive in 1981 would, like, go through this and be like, wow, these evil people kidnapped the president and crashed
right. Right.
At the end, he does get rescued. So it's a good story with all these good guys. And you're looking at it in a context of just, like, looking at this Stewart as hijacker as kind of a hero.
Right, right.
He's like, Snake, get in there and finish the job. But
Right. Well, I think that, like...
It's very interesting. And last little thought on it is absolutely. Just, like, yeah, we rescued him and... A much darker movie would be like, you know what? The president doesn't matter. Blam, blam, blam. But instead, his approach is more of a, all right, I'll just embarrass him with the wrong tape kind of thing.
Right.
So it doesn't go as dark as it probably could have if it went that route, I don't think. I think that's what gets the movie not made.
Mm-hmm. I'd agree. And I think there's part of me that wants to see an alternate version of the film where the Duke actualizes his plan, you know? I kind of think that maybe the message of this movie, like I said, the lie is that they believe the president is important. I don't think the United States military was about to let everyone in this penal colony just walk right back into society, even if they did have the president. The United States government is not above killing the president. Okay, people. I think that it's like, I think the hellscape of capitalism in this movie is that I think everyone believes, including the Duke. Like, honestly, the Duke is a hero. He's at odds with our protagonist, but I fucking love what he's about, dude. Like, he's trying to liberate fucking everybody in that city. He's honestly, in many ways, acting like selflessly in this regard. I just think that it would have never worked. I think they would have, like, literally just detonated bombs and destroyed the bridge before they let them, you know, like, have leverage over them in this type of situation.
Yeah. Wishful thinking, but when you're stuck on an island, that's all you really have to cling on to.
Right.
It is, what was I going to say about the Duke? Oh, no, not about the Duke. In the intro of the movie, they do mention that it's not... You know, the New York Police Department. It is the United States Police Force.
So right, yeah.
Another little statement on the
I didn't catch
things.
That. That's a good thought, yeah.
Interesting. Prescient, even, if I may.
So I've got a follow-up question for you. Really for both of us. We have been talking about how... Like, this has been, like, the Snake Plissken episode. Kind of like last episode was the Dudes episode. So let me ask you this. Who is your favorite character in the movie other than Snake?
I was trying to find a way to work this note in, Denny.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, I was watching it on Amazon Prime, and I had the little... every once in a while, hit a button to turn on the little X-ray thing to see, like... Oh, who's playing Hauk right now? Okay. And I think my favorite character, besides the Duke, who's just undeniable, I think it is. I wouldn't have picked this if I didn't do the X-ray to find out that the character's name is Romero, and it's the dude with like the Sonic the Hedgehog hair and the zombie looking makeup.
I call Romero, him Methio instead of Rufio.
I like that. Romero looks like a zombie. That feels like a little nod. That was great.
So I caught that another character is called Cronenberg later in the movie, and I wondered if that was a nod. And IMDb
did he
trivia,
have a hand growing out of his head or something? Like,
no.
Was it
the
a
trivia
fly,
saying
by
their references to David Cronenberg, George A. Romero, and a director named Don Taylor. There's a character named Taylor, as someone whose last name is Taylor. I can tell you it's not something that piques your interest when you hear that name.
No relation. The Omen. Dude. Oh, Planet of the Apes.
Oh, and the original Escape. Island of Dr. Moreau. Oh,
Escape
okay.
From the Planet of the Apes.
Okay, so just again, another classic director. So yeah, you caught one, I caught one, and there was a third that why would you question why someone's name was Taylor, but it was a reference apparently.
Yeah. We have a basic ass name, Denny.
Yeah, I know. I hate it. I'm going to change it. Get ready.
Did old Donnie boy here do... I'm looking through Don Taylor's filmography. Now I'm on a Escape from Planet of the Apes. I need to see.
Maybe it's because he made an escape movie.
Mm.
He made an escape from movie.
Escape. I mean, that's part of his contract. He has all the rights to escape from movies. Unless you put a character named after him into your movie, you can't do an escape from blank.
Oh, fuck. Billy Wilder directed
The Omen.
Oh, wait,
2.
I'm on Stalag 17.
All right, that's enough of Don Taylor corner. Sorry to disrespect your great uncle or whatever.
It's okay. I also wanted to share that my favorite character in this movie is Cabbie. And much like Greg likes the genre getting the band back together, the micro genre, I really love the micro genre of cabbies and cabbie characters. I don't know what my best guess is that when I was a kid, I played a lot of Crazy Taxi. And so I think that probably influenced me. And in the late 2010s, I had to drive for Uber to support my counseling habit. So I always kind of wish that I was in like a yellow cab driving around a big city instead of being in my personal vehicle driving around the suburbs and having a really bad time. But I love Cabbie. Cabbie's cool as shit.
Yeah, I like him. He's very cool. It's just like, the kind of character like I know my way around everything. I know where everything is, and I know pretty much all of the people as well. Mm-hmm. Just someone that just knows the ropes, but is so low level that they're just like, here's the knowledge. I'll tell you. You don't have to put a gun to my head. I'll just chat with you a little bit, and kind of a smart character when he swaps the hat for the tape.
Yes.
Kind of like, oh, thanks, bud.
Yeah, dude. Fucking awesome. Dude, he was good. Honestly, his death fucked with me the most in the movie. Like, he was just, like, a very eager beaver looking to help and, like, really believed that Snake was someone he could trust to get him out of here. And he made it to the finish line. He made it to the finish line. All that goes to say, I think the U.S. government might have just, like, immediately shot him in the head if he made it out. So I don't know that he was ever going to get out. But, like...
that would have been a lot worse.
To paraphrase Sam Elliott for the second time in this podcast, I didn't like seeing Cabbie go.
Oh. you're talking about that being the death that messed you up the most. The death that confused me the most was Maggie, because I'm still unclear on how she died.
So this
all
is
of a sudden she's on the floor covered in blood. I'm like, something hit her? What happened?
Oh, did you miss the hit? It's amazing.
I guess I did.
So like basically this is what happens is she looks to Snake for the gun after Brain dies, her partner. Snake
like
tosses it
lot,
to
yeah.
her. My impression, nothing is said, but my impression is that she wanted the gun to kill herself. She wasn't going to go forward with Snake without her partner, and there's obviously nothing to go back to. So I thought that it was an unspoken, you don't want to come, end your life, here you go. But then she has this change of heart when she sees the Duke coming. And she decides she's going to use the gun to try to help Snake, to try to help the people get out. and it's like, it's really quick, so I see how you missed it. But the Duke is driving towards her while she's shooting at him, and eventually he crashes right the fuck into her. And let me tell you, the dummy that they had to get hit by that car took it like a fucking hero. Like, it's a really quick shot, but like, Vanessa and I both went like, fucking damn! Like, it was like a good looking dummy that they used, and they just for real crashed a car right the fuck into it. So that was pretty cool.
I must have blinked, or like,
it is quick. It's a very short little shot, because I doubt it looked good for long. You know, like, I doubt it was you didn't want like some light to shine on it, so to speak.
Yeah, we couldn't put that much cleavage on a dummy, so
Bro, the titties out in this movie. This is a very titties out movie.
Yeah, this is a this is Clue levels of bosoms.
Gosh, Clue win the movie for like horniest movie? Did that win the award?
Yeah, I think that won the Grinny for horniest movie.
It was a very horny movie.
It either won or was like runner up. It was shocking.
So, could I give a couple of wrestling thoughts on this movie? Because there is what we call a CZW match in it.
By all means.
So, the wrestler used, you can probably guess which one, is a wrestler by the name of Ox Baker. Snake has to fight him in like a deathmatch cage ring thing with baseball bat spikes. Ox Baker is really cool. He's like an old world wrestler. He's like from like the territory days. I would say the modern era of wrestling starts in 1985, when WrestleMania 1 happened, and I just think that that's what modern American wrestling became. Ox Baker is a cool ass territories guy. You should look into him. If you saw from this movie, bro has a one of a kind look. He looks like a fucking pro wrestler. And that's awesome. I also joked that Snake's tattoo is pro wrestler levels of bad, so they sent him to wrestle Ox Baker. We see that tattoo right before he gets in the ring, and I like, guys, I can name probably less than 5 wrestlers who have good tattoos. That is like, it's such a terrible only tattoo on Mr. Pliskin. You know, it looks really rough. I'd also throw out, as storytelling in this movie, as a wrestling fan, I really appreciate the dedication to long-term storytelling with the leg, to sell your leg for this long of a match, so to speak. So, like, in a classic wrestling match, they'll usually work a body part, and that'll kind of be the story of the match, trying to get to this body part, trying to soften it up. And to tell a good story in your match, it's really hard to work the leg, because you're going to be beating up the good guy, right, and trying to hurt the good guy's leg. And if the good guy is selling properly, he shouldn't be able to do a lot of his cool shit, because his leg is injured. He shouldn't be able to, like, jump off the top rope or pick you up and hold you on his shoulders or anything like that. And so most leg matches just ignore that, and that's why I don't really like them. This movie had Snake Plissken selling it since like the beginning of the second act, essentially. Dude is selling a leg wound for the whole fucking movie, and he never stopped selling it. And I just thought that was something that is very psychologically challenging to do to your protagonist in a story. I just thought that was cool. Those are my wrestling thoughts on this movie.
Every time he ran away or like was, you know, getting somewhere and was like limping the leg like that, fuck yes, commit. Way to go.
So good.
Love this.
So good. And it happens all the time in movies too. The leg just gets better.
Yeah. No kidding. And it was kind of a, he got shot with an arrow. I'm trying to remember why. Oh, because the president was like, oh, and then the guy was like, what are you looking at? And I'm like, come on, man. Way to ruin your own rescue. Fucking idiot. I love everything you said. The wrestler, I should have thought to ask you about him. He looked like, especially with what he was wearing, he looked like he could have been like in a 1940s Muscle Man magazine cover or whatever.
Oh yeah, yeah. No, he's old world, which makes it so cool that John Carpenter chose someone like him instead of like, I don't know, fucking Coco Beware or something from the WWF of this time period. I thought that was dope.
He's got this, his beard, it doesn't look fake, but it looks so done up. Yeah, that is just it just helps sell that a little better.
And
I think
the
it looks
eyebrows
good.
Too. They're a very big part of the character. The eyebrows are fucking wild.
It's so cool. Yeah, did you have any other questions or anything? Or is it just wrestling corners all wrapped up?
I had a few IMDb trivia notes to share at one point, but
yeah,
they're not huge.
Yeah, because why did we go there in the first place?
Because we didn't know much trivia about it. So, actually, there's
not
much trivia either.
We wanted to know if the tattoo was... Yeah.
Okay, the tattoo is not listed. To your eye patch lore, Kurt Russell did suggest the eye patch in this movie. So he has Kurt Russell, flip-flopper on eye patches, lady and gentlemen. Can't stick to one side of the issue or one side of the face. So these are the two most interesting things I saw here. One is just that this miniature city was repainted and used for Blade Runner, the original boring one. But wow. The only thing I do like about that Blade Runner is its environment. And so that's a real easy crossover. It's easy to see how those might be the same things. This is what I popped for. We've already discussed her in the Freakier Friday section, but the narration in the beginning and the computer's voice in the first prison scene is Jamie Lee Curtis, uncredited.
Okay.
That was awesome.
Oh, okay. I knew it was like something about it was giving me the feel of like Sigourney Weaver, but I knew that was wrong. But I knew I recognized it.
Yeah.
Because Sigourney Weaver does a lot of robot voiceovers, including, as mentioned, I believe she was the robot computer voiceover in Alio, if I'm not mistaken. Let me double check that. But yeah, just I hear computer voice and I think Sigourney Weaver.
I mean, but she was a whole ass robot in Alien 3, so.
Well, there you go.
Is that 3 or 4? The Winona Ryder one. That's 3, right?
That is 4, Resurrection.
She might be a robot in that one.
3 is the prison planet thing.
3 is the Fight Club guy. What's his fucking name? David. Who made Fight Club? Why am I having
David
such a
Fincher.
Hard time? David Fincher.
I was thinking actors, so I wasn't helping you. I should have got that quicker.
David Fincher.
I was thinking 3 was Game of Thrones guy.
David Fincher did a bad job.
I think he was given dog shit. You should watch Zodiac. That's all I'm going to say.
I'll check it out. I also really like Alien 3 until the CGI alien shows up. So that ruins the fucking movie really bad.
Not the best.
But that's all the like interesting trivia I felt like. The dude trying to get into the cockpit at the beginning of the movie is the son of Gerald Ford. So that's actually kind of interesting that that's the son of an actual president. I doubt that he is an actor full time. Or did he nepotism? Oh my god, he's in Starship Troopers, When Harry Met Sally, Black Hawk fucking Down. This guy's daddy got him a career. Anyway.
Oh.
He's an actual actor, not just a cameo. When I read that trivia, I assumed they just found some president's son who wasn't busy that day. I don't know.
Yeah, I wonder what he feels about the other themes of the movie. My mistake, guys. Sigourney Weaver was the voice of the aquarium announcements in Finding Dory, the other Pixar movie I watched recently, but barely paid attention to, so I didn't really feel like calling it out in what we've been watching. So, sorry, Sigourney Weaver.
Not sorry, Ellen DeGeneres. We know who you really are. Yeah, that was all I really had, though. Do you want to do gimmicks now?
I am down to gimmick our way out of here. Escape from the episode, if I may. Denny, it's going to go lots of ways. What is your diesel spot? Again, in a movie featuring like combat in a ring, like with Raging Bull, what is your diesel spot for Escape from New York?
So I did, again, pick a literal one. My metaphorical ones I've kind of talked about, like directorial snake ripping up the tape at the end is one I really like. And also just, like, generally being leftist and, like critical of the structure of the society we live in. That was just something I was like, you're a powerhouse. But I think I'm going to go literal and give it to my favorite character, Cabby. And is when he just, like, very nonchalantly lit and threw a Molotov cocktail at the crazies. And he was just like, oh, Snake, welcome. These things are kind of rare around here. Boom!
And he's got, like, a a metal hatch on the roof of his car that is for throwing Molotov cocktails.
So yeah, I'm gonna go with when my favorite character, aka the Diesel of the movie, so to speak, literally just killed a bunch of jobbers in the most literal sense.
It was probably just regular unleaded gasoline and not diesel
fuel. Oh, that's a good point.
In those bottles. So.
That's a good point.
It's the performance, you're kind of thinking this is more of like a lighthearted, jovial type of guy that just like wouldn't harm a fly. And then he's like talking his way through like why he's lighting this Molotov cocktail. It's good. It's a really good turn. Really helps sell you on the world. That's a good pick.
What about you, Big Daddy Cool?
I went the directorial route for my Diesel spot, and it is, like I talked about earlier, the varied score. It is the music that plays. It's pretty much just the whole scene, but mostly the music carrying it. The scene where we introduce the Duke.
Right.
His whole caravan is pulling up. He's been talked up a lot, and like, he rolls up in this fucking Cadillac with like chandelier headlights or whatever the fuck's going on. It's wild. And like the music playing is just cooler than cool. Like it feels almost out of place, but this is like a wild sequence of insane characters, and it just it works for the character that we're introducing. I thought it was great.
Absolutely.
I love that part. And I will say, while you were in, during Wrestling Corner, I must admit, I was tabbing over to watch Maggie's death scene on the side there.
Awesome.
I was more looking at the car crashing into the car, and I missed that there was a person in front, between the two cars. And holy shit, you weren't kidding.
Yeah, the way she's bleeding, kind of to me, like, it might imply that she was kind of chopped in half. Like, there's so much blood coming from the midsection, and we don't see from the waist down. So part of me wonders if, man, did she get really gnarlied up, you know?
Yeah, I think you might be right, and I think we showed what we could here. Denny, what's your favorite line from Escape from New York?
So there's obviously some runners-up, but I'm really going to flip the genre on its head. One that I already talked about is I loved the president saying, oh, I want to thank them. This nation appreciates their sacrifices, realizing that he has fucked up everything, without realizing that he's fucking up everything he's worked for. Mm-hmm. I liked that. I really liked calling the World Trade Center the only place you can land. That is my favorite use of the Twin Towers in this movie.
How did we not comment on intentionally flying a plane onto the World Trade Center?
I mean, I was intentionally saving it. That's how I didn't comment on it.
Okay. I was like, not only are the buildings featured, they're putting a plane on them is pivotal to the plot. Like,
well,
we
see them a
up.
Lot. We see a lot of the World Trade Centers in this, and I actually had a moment where I was like, man, can you believe they thought these would still be around in, wait, 1997?
Yeah,
oh,
so good.
Shit, this is like the only futuristic New York movie I've ever seen that was right about that. They were still there in 97.
Another thing we got right.
My line, I'm going to flip it on its head. My favorite line was a choice for there to be no line. And it was for Snake to just not say anything while he tore up the tape. And that's the last scene of the movie. I thought not giving him dialogue in that moment was actually my favorite use of dialogue, or lack thereof, so to speak. So we'll let the judges decide if that technically counts as a favorite line. But to me, the most impactful parts of this movie were the silences in those ways.
Yeah, real brooding, cool, quiet type Snake Plissken. My favorite line is also from the end of the movie, I think right before he rips up the tape. Hulk asks, you gonna kill me now, Snake? Not now. I'm too tired.
God, that's awesome.
Maybe later. Fuck yeah. Relatable king.
Gets offered the sweet government job and gives him a nice big go fuck yourself. I am not helping this nation. So fucking awesome.
He's like, when I get back, I'm gonna kill you. Hawk's trying to hold him to that. Like, you said you would. It was weird. Hawk, I feel like, the actor playing him was very good in the role, but very obviously, like, not obviously, I should say, but, like, he just seemed a little old for the kind of guy in charge of the police badass type, but I don't know. Maybe it was the hair. I think if he trimmed it a little bit more.
Yeah.
Had a little bit of Doc Brown going on up there.
Yeah, you would think, like, a military guy would have more of a crew cut, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But then again, I don't know, is he in the military, or is he just, like, a high-ranking, like,
he's in
officer
the United. He's the commissioner of the United States Police Force.
Ah, there we go. So kind of like the military is now.
Yeah.
He's like, so he's, like, the head of the general. National Guard in 2025?
I guess so.
I'd take him over what we got. So, Greg, what's your movie score?
Oh, my critic score for Escape to New York. I gave it a 32 out of 40. That is an 8 out of 10. Kind of on the lower side, but, you know, we've covered the heaviest hitters. I think this is a straightforward fucking blast of a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I will absolutely watch it again. It's, you know, just not one of my upper echelon favorite movies ever, but that is not an insult whatsoever. It's a good flick.
No, yeah, I think similarly to you, I scored it lower than we have most things in this film, or most things in this series, but I also scored most things in this series a 50 out of 50, you know, so that's not really an insult. This is my lowest score that we've done. I gave it a 43 out of 50, which, again, that is not an insult. That's saying this is a great movie. I don't know why, but 43 feels like a special number to me in this process, like literally just with reviewing movies. And 43 has always been something I give movies that are like kind of special to me, but aren't like over the super top amazing, you know? And I really think that honestly, the only difference between Escape from New York and another movie like Inglourious Basterds that I rate higher is that I don't think Escape from New York has the emotional depth that some of those other movies do. I think Carpenter is much more concerned with his message about capitalism than he is with like what the characters are really feeling deep down, you know, and like what informs their actions and what they've been through. I think he still like he does a great job, and it totally works for this movie because it's supposed to be like this, you know, like we know very little about Snake. He's not a fleshed out character at all. That's awesome. That's how everyone else feels about him when they're in the movie. You know, like the audience is dealing with the same level of like lore and mysticism behind it.
Yeah, for sure. I think I'm kind of landing on the same page as you. Just that emotional connection isn't there, and it's not supposed to be.
But again, not an insult. This is just it's the more surface level good time than some of the more in-depth things. But again, doesn't make me think less of it in the slightest. 43 is a very high rating. I really like this movie.
Something to be said for achieving your goals.
Right, right.
Is what you were going for. Yeah, I like it. All right, I think we've successfully escaped before the little things in our neck arteries can explode. I think we've done it just under the wire there. But yeah, you know, had to deviate a little bit into Freakier Friday territory. We're really pushing it there, but luckily the little x-rays have deactivated the explosives in our neck, Denny.
Man,
we're donezo.
I'm glad we made it without a moment to spare.
We might have to turn them back on, though, because what are we doing next week? Because I actually don't remember what we're doing next week.
So it's our final entry, and since Greg doesn't remember, maybe we'll just let it
be
a surprise.
You can just pick anything.
Well, yeah, we're going to do another John Carpenter movie next week. It's our final entry in the Rumble, and every great Royal Rumble has a surprise entrant. I will remind Greg off air so he knows what movie to watch. But I think maybe for the audience, maybe we'll have a surprise entrant because, you know, in the 2011 Royal Rumble, after the character hadn't been seen since 1996, my favorite surprise entry ever was the return of Diesel. Maybe we should let last week be the surprise, or the next week be the surprise entrant that pops everyone.
Okay.
It's like a good one, guys.
It's its own Diesel spot. Love that. Yep. Well, cool. Yeah, thanks for joining, everybody. We're almost wrapping up on this theme here. Good-ass time I'm having so far. I really like this. This was a good idea by us. Damn, we're smart. We're good at this. Speaking of things that we're really good at. Denny, you're the number one top world champion of catchphrases. Show them what you got.
For Greg Work, the escape from the old way of life because he's a parent, Johnson.
Hmm.
I'm Denny, the escape from reality because I'm mentally ill, Taylor. And this has been Movies for When. We already told you when. But you know what we didn't tell you? What's my snake again?
I'm a policeman. See my badge?